Good evening and welcome to this particular program of the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. I want to welcome all of you on behalf of not only the Commonwealth Club, but the San Jose Women's Club and the Marriage Equality Working Group of the American Leadership Forum. I am Steve Smith. I'm a Silicon Valley businessman. My day job is as an investment banker. I got involved in this project because my wife and I happen to have a gay son. He's happily married, but had the misfortune of marrying a British gentleman. And because of that, our immigration laws do not allow him to bring his spouse here to the United States, and thus he lives eight time zones away. Seems rather bizarre, but that's the way it is, and that's the basic background for why I got involved in trying to make a difference here. My panelists tonight include Randy Pond. Randy is an executive vice president at Cisco. He's an 18-year veteran of one of Silicon Valley's greatest companies. He's a hero there for many reasons. Most of the company reports to him, actually, but he won't tell you that. he would quickly point out that they don't do what he tells them to do either, but that's beside the point. Randy's here tonight for his own personal reasons. He is a heterosexual Catholic male family man who simply feels like the time has come to fix this civil rights problem. Said in a simple way, I hope. Melanie Aaron is on the panel tonight. Melanie is a rabbi with Congregation Shir Hadash in Los Gatos. She is a leader in the Reform Jewish movement. She's also a heterosexual family person, but she's had a very different perspective, I think, on marriage and marriage equality, and is, you know, the kind of community leader that wants to make sure the right things happen, the right things change, and she's done a great deal to get involved in this cause. Both Randy and Melanie appear in the film. You saw some of what they said in the film. There are some other interesting comments they make. Both are terrific community leaders, even though they have day jobs that would keep them perfectly fully occupied. And finally, let me introduce Jeff Coors. Jeff is the expert panelist tonight. Jeff is a gay male, also a family man, but he has dedicated a great portion of his professional life to causes related to lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people. We have with us tonight a man who has led the causes in the state of California while running an organization called Equality California. He has probably been responsible for passing more legislation related to these causes than any other individual in any state anywhere in the country. And he's a passionate advocate for equality in marriage for same-sex couples, among other things. He also knows more than the rest of the panelists, I suspect, on the details of each individual law and regulation that cause problems for us. So I want to thank the three panelists for joining us tonight. I want to give them an opportunity to talk to the rest of us about their perspectives and get a sense for why these three very different people come out the same place on the topic of gay marriage. Let me start by asking each of them to tell you a little bit about their personal experience and how they came to be advocates for this particular issue. I'd like each of them to tell you a little bit about when this issue became important to them, how their position has changed over time on this issue, because I'm sure it has. It's true for all of us. And I think it's a good way to get to know a little bit about their background. So, Randy, would you give us your personal perspective?
Sure. So I would actually say that my perspective on the gay and lesbian marriage probably started when I first moved to California in 1980. I worked with a young girl who was of Japanese-American descent. And I had never heard of the anti-miscegenation laws. And even though I was college-educated, it had never been made aware to me. And she, her father was a Japanese soldier, and her mother was, actually she was a member of the Daughters of American Revolution, if you can believe this, and they married in like 1949. And they unfortunately lived in states that had these laws. And as a young child, despite the fact the entire family was bilingual, they never, ever spoke Japanese outside of the home. And they passed themselves off as Eskimos, which I thought was horrific at the time. And I was, it was sort of an epiphany for me that something could happen where, due to sort of what I would consider, you know, horrible laws, that a family could be put in this circumstance. Then when the marriage equality came up in California, I was actually approached by both friends of mine and by people out of our gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender organization inside of Cisco to see if I had a stance. And I did, because as I said in the film, I think this is fundamentally a civil rights issue, and it strikes me as just horribly unfair that so very few would be encumbered with what I think are just crappy treatment by the federal government, state governments in the U.S. today. Having said that, I want to be really candid. I grew up in a lower income neighborhood. The most of my neighbors are and were homophobic. They were racist as a small child. I grew up in a little community in Indiana. So my background would not have led me here. I would say my move to California, my engagement with people over the course of the last 25 or 30 years has probably changed where I came from to where I'm at today.
Thank you. Melanie?
So I'd like to talk about three experiences I have that have moved me to involve myself in this issue. The first was the suicide of the younger brother of one of my friends. He was the golden boy of our high school years. He played the guitar, and we all thought he was James Taylor, which probably dates me in terms of what was popular when I was in high school. And the irony was his parents were good liberal Jewish psychologists who would have had no problem with him coming out. And it was clear to me that what was going on in the society around him had as much impact as his family's attitudes. And it made me realize that it's not enough to make changes within your own small circle, but that the changes have to be broader. The second experience I had was as a rabbi in Brooklyn in a mostly older congregation in the mid-80s when the reform movement took a stance in favor of the ordination of gay and lesbian candidates for the rabbinate. And I led a discussion about this for the congregation, and I was so nervous because the congregation was mostly older people. And I had forgotten that everyone understood that our organist at the time was a gay man, and they only saw this in terms of him. And, of course, anything that would make his life better was good, and it made me realize how even the contact with one individual who's willing to share their story can have such a big impact on people who might otherwise not be sympathetic. And then the last thing was after I left Brooklyn, one of the candidates was a woman who was a lesbian, and I was advising her that it was a great congregation, but that she shouldn't tell them right away because they should love her first, and then I was sure that they would come round. And she was very uncomfortable with that, and I went home after the conversation, and I realized how impossible it would be to function as a rabbi and have your personal life so hidden, that so many of the examples you use in sermons are about just things that happen in everyday life or in counseling. And it made me realize that saying to people, oh, you know, just kind of stay halfway in the closet really wasn't a solution, and that we had to go further than we had gone so far as a society.
Jeff.
Great, thank you. You know, I think for me, there are probably also three sort of things that have, you know, moved me from, obviously, as a gay man, I've always cared about the issue of equality for LGBT people. But to really make this a really important issue, marriage equality, a very important issue. In mid-1990s, I was working at the ACLU in Chicago. And one of my first cases was what was the first co-parent adoption in Chicago, in the state of Illinois, actually. And what it was two women who had two children. One was the birth mother. And the other mother couldn't adopt her own children. So if something happened to the birth mother, the kids would go into foster care because they weren't recognized as a family. And I realized sort of in that time, and that's when the Hawaii marriage case, the first marriage case, was moving forward, that if we had marriage equality, this wouldn't be necessary. This battle wouldn't be going on to just have legal rights to be a parent of your own children. The second thing that I think really pushed me even further was in 2004, being in City Hall when marriage equality started and having so many friends who got married who did it more as a political act at the time, who said it transformed their relationships. People have been together 20, 30 years who talked about the personal impact it had. And I think the last thing really that I sort of want to touch on was sort of more personal, which is when my partner James and I became domestic partners in California back in 2006. You know, my family was, congratulations, whatever, you know, sort of nice. But my mom said how she looked forward to dancing with me at my wedding like she did with my brother. And it was really then I realized the impact it had beyond just, you know, LGBT people personally, but to their families and friends, the significance of that moment when you do say those vows to each other with all those witnesses, people you care about who are then there to support your relationship. It means something different to be married in our society than it is to be a civil union person or a domestic partner. And so I think those are different angles of how it's really impacted me from caring about the equality issue to really realizing this is a societal change that just has to happen.
Thank you. One of the things that I hear a lot, and I suspect all of us do, is that, well, society is moving in the right direction on this issue. Why are we so worried about it? It's inevitable that we're going to come around to the right answer. We hear things in the news every so often that people are softening up and so forth. In fact, I saw a very interesting statistical analysis by an economist who deals with strange statistical things, saying that we just passed the point where half of the population believes that same-sex marriage is a good idea. So why is this issue important? I think I want to ask each of the panelists to comment. Why should we care? Why should we worry about it? Isn't this going to resolve itself anyway? Aren't there more important things we could worry about? Who wants to take that?
A brief kind of pastoral answer, and that is,
no, you can. As we would expect, yes.
That, you know, that's fine to say in the long run it's all going to be fine, but there's a lot of pain and suffering in the short term, and I think that we need to change attitudes and to make things right as soon as possible and not just wait until it works out. I see families that have contorted themselves in some very strange ways, and it puts a lot of stress on the adults and on the children because of these laws and because of these attitudes. And the time to make the change is now.
I would add, you know, sure, you can look, you know, down the road and believe that society will always go to the better place. But I think it is what damage is done in the meantime. And, you know, there are people who will never be able to get married because their partners passed away. My mom passed away several years ago, so we won't have that moment at my wedding. Those are things that never can be fixed, and the longer you wait, the more people that go through that. And I think someone made a really great point in the film, which I think we should highlight, which is young LGBT and questioning children growing up. You know, growing up in a society where you are told that who you are and how you love and who you love is not worthy of government protection, well, that leads to suicide. That leads to hate crimes. If we change things more quickly, we will help save lives. There's no question about it. And those young people will grow up with that norm that, you know, whether they're lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, heterosexual, no different than if they have, you know, blonde hair or dark hair. It's just who they are, and they can realize any dream they want. And that's going to have a profound impact on people's lives right now.
Good point. Randy, you want to add anything?
The only thing I think I would add is that I don't think we can allow ourselves to acquiesce to being patient on the subject of basic civil rights. Somebody's constantly got to be pushing the needle forward more aggressively than just waiting for it to happen. I believe we're going to get there as well. But to all the points that both Melanie and Jeff made, the consequences in the interim are just fundamentally unacceptable. And I think it's going to be the vocal few that carry this thing. So staying vocal and driving this thing hard is all we can really do.
And there are people every day who are suffering the consequences. And some of those consequences become permanent if it doesn't get resolved. Tax law, immigration law, everything related to the benefits between couples. Somebody suffers every day. And I think Randy is right that if you don't speak up, you're part of the problem. Ladoris at the end of the film made that point powerfully. I mean, the heroes are the ones that'll take it on when they don't have to. Okay. Randy, I'd love to get the corporate perspective here. I mean, you're a guy who's responsible for making a return for shareholders. You care a lot every day about the P&L and the balance sheet. You deal in a very competitive global market, and you're driving a hard-charging, competitive company in that market. Why does a guy like you feel like this matters to the corporation? I mean, you've got a lot of people that work for Cisco that you care about, but why does this matter? Does it enhance the P&L if we fix this? Should shareholders care?
Well, so I would answer the question in a couple of different ways. First, I think from a cultural perspective, Cisco is an absolute believer in doing what's right for our employees. And that includes the gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender community, which is, it's not a huge percentage of our population, but it's large. And they have their own employee resource group. We're big believers in diversity driving benefits for the corporation and therefore for our shareholders. And once you embrace them as part of the employee community, then we think it's really incumbent on the corporation to bring as much as we can to help close the gaps that they have in the marketplace. Things like, we modified our application of the Family Medical Leave Act to include partners. We modified our 401k plan to include rights for partners. We've modified our tax benefits. We harmonize the tax they have to pay on medical benefits because it's the right thing to do for the employees. Because if you want to bring the employee into the business as an employee of equals with the rest of the employees, then you got to knock down as many obstacles as you can for them. The second side of the coin is the 1,100 regulations and the hundreds and hundreds of state laws is an administrative nightmare. It is not unusual to discover that the way we treat partners in some states puts us at odds with state law, which then we have to go to the employee and say, we're going to have to modify this thing. We're very sorry, but now we're against the law again. We find that kind of, quite frankly, lunacy, and it's overhead that we've got to keep in place. And it's so complicated an environment for the employee that we regularly run, financial planning seminars, benefits seminars, the evolution of government regulation seminars for the LGBT organizations to talk about what the evolution of this is, which we bear the expense ourselves because it is a different world for them than it is for the standard employees who have the rights that they don't. So I think there's a pragmatic side that says it's the right thing for the employee. It matches our culture perfectly. And there's the other side, which is, we're paying an overhead that goes with the fact that we can't treat everybody the same. It's just a fact inside of the business today. Having said both of those things, the bottom line for us is we just need some definitive nature in this space. The fact that the laws evolve in a way that just creates a massive amount of confusion, it's bad for the employee and it's bad for corporations. And I think it puts people at odds. Now, having said all of that, I want you to know this is not of one mind at Cisco. We have a very large but small but very vocal community that it was very strong on Proposition 8. And I got lots of hate email. I got killed in the blogosphere for a few weeks, but I think that just comes with the territory. So this is a very divisive issue inside of Cisco as well.
Interesting. Do you feel that other companies are as progressive or are getting the message?
I actually do. I think if you talk to any – well, I should be careful. I think in the high-tech community, if you look at, Adobe, HP, IBM, Microsoft, SAP, Oracle, I think they're going to be of a very similar ilk. I can't speak for the more traditional companies. I just don't have much experience there. I also think, unfortunately, a lot of this is still very regional. So I'm not certain mm-hmm. you're going to get the same emphasis in the South, or maybe in the Midwest, quite frankly, that you would get out here in terms of supporting your employee base.
So you would encourage taking this panel to Alabama?
That would be interesting.
Steve, if I could just add something. Please. On the issue of employment. We had a young man in the congregation who graduated from Harvard last year, and he was very motivated to think about giving back to the world, and he wanted to do Teach for America. But a lot of the states where they were looking for teachers were places where he felt, as a gay man, it wouldn't really be safe and secure for him. He'd have to be closeted. He couldn't be out. So he ended up working for Google, which I know here is a success story and everybody's happy. But for me, yeah. But for me, I think it's sad that we have one less really bright and talented teacher. And I think that kind of thing happens a lot.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Melanie. You made the statement that there is a difference between religious marriage and civil marriage, that this really should be looked at as a civil marriage issue. I'm sure that there are people who look to their religious beliefs as the reason why they are not ready to see this move happen. How do you think this will change? Will it change? What's necessary to get people beyond their religious concerns?
Well, I think it's a misperception that every religious group is opposed to equal rights for GLBT people and that they oppose gay and lesbian marriages. Though there are some large religious groups that are very active in opposition, the Mormons and the Catholic Church, there are also lots of Protestant denominations that are very forward-looking on this. It's also a real irritant to me because I'm associated with the Hebrew Scriptures, which Christians call the Old Testament, and the Old Testament is often blamed for much of this. While those same Christian groups don't really embrace all of the laws of the Old Testament, they're kind of picking and choosing. So in the section of Leviticus where one of the prohibitions that's mentioned most frequently occurs, there are a whole lot of laws that Christians don't view as incumbent upon themselves. And so it really seems disingenuous to blame this on the Bible when you're not really interested in the rest of the laws in that section. Also, even for that particular law about not lying with a man as with a woman, Bible scholars feel that this isn't really about homosexuality the way we understand it today. It was really more about a sort of form of rape that took place in terms of acting out dominance and demeaning somebody in ancient society. And since it doesn't have anything to do with our societal norms as it is, and since we don't listen to the rest of the laws in the chapter anyway, it just doesn't seem right to blame this whole problem on religious viewpoints. I think that people can be reassured that no one is going to force their church into doing marriages that they oppose. This isn't requiring that people get married. This is only allowing those who want to be married to be married. And I think if we see it that way, and if we see it part of the whole tradition in the United States of separation of church and state, of allowing people the practice of their religion, my religious community allows these weddings. Why are they not also legal?
Mm-hmm. And in our experience, the fact that in the United Kingdom you could have a civil marriage, we had the same marriage for our son and his partner as we had here in the United States for our daughter and her husband, her traditional husband. And it was, as Jeff pointed out, a terrific experience for the parents and the friends and the entire family and all of that, and it was like it never occurred to us at that point in time that we were missing something because it wasn't in a church. And why can't that happen?
And there are many churches right here in this community that would be very happy to have the wedding right in the church.
Sure,
so
sure.
It just depends.
And you're active
from one
in the Interfaith Council and so forth. Do you see active progress on this?
We've had some degree of progress in that we've had coalitions that are willing to speak out against homophobia, even if they cannot come as far as supporting marriage equality, and that's some degree of progress. In hierarchical organizations, it's harder to make progress.
Sounds like a corporate statement.
But I think she's applying it to the Catholic Church.
Yeah. Yes.
Which I also can speak on if you want to. But
understood. Jeff, let me ask you to help us understand some of the depth and detail of the regulatory and legislative environments that affects people. It's sort of hard to fathom the notion that there are 1,100 federal laws and regulations and some 400, I guess, as stated in the film, that are statewide. Those are huge numbers. And I'm curious, I suspect the audience is curious here, what are some of the things that are frequently not recognized as legal or regulatory problems that same-sex couples face?
Sure. And there are so many in such a broad array, many things, you know, you don't even think about. I think one of them that has come up is immigration. And in some cases, and there have been, unfortunately, way too many of these, not only does the couple not able to stay in this country, but sometimes they can't be together anywhere in the world because neither of the countries they're citizens will recognize the relationship. And so couples have been split up. Families have been split up, kids from their parents. It's just an awful and tragic situation. One that was pointed out to me a couple of years ago, which just I think just shows in a way the absurdity, is I could be married in my lifetime to 5 different women, each for a decade. And when I died, if they all survived me, they each get Social Security survivor benefits, the full amount. I could be legally married in California, one of the states where it's married, to my husband for 50 years, and he would get nothing, zero, and would end up, you know, potentially, you know, needing state assistance. I mean, that's how absurd the current system is. And I think one that highlights a whole bunch of the areas, today I saw an article that the Navy has decided that in those states where same-sex couples can get married, members of the Navy can marry a same-sex partner at the base, which is really terrific progress now that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was voted to be lifted. That said, the spouse of the person in the Navy is entitled to absolutely none of the benefits that a heterosexual spouse would happen. If the person serving our country loses their life fighting for our country, their same-sex spouse wouldn't be entitled to get their remains, would get no survivor benefits, is not entitled to be notified as next of kin. That is how horrendous a situation that we're dealing with is. People are being denied the most basic humanity. And it's not just the rights that come with it, it's the message that it sends when the government actually mandates discrimination against a group of people and the dignity that goes with that. So it's both all those rights and, you know, over the 1,100 you mentioned, but it's also the dignity that goes with the government saying you're not entitled to the same thing everyone else is. You're less than others.
It really sounds absurd when we hear you talk about these things. And yet, you know, is it just neglect that people aren't paying attention to this? There are more important topics? Or what is it in the legislative process that creates so much inertia here? Why doesn't this just get solved right away?
You know, I think ultimately it doesn't get solved right away because, at least, you know, in California, the court was willing to say the majority of voters gets to decide if a minority should have their rights, which is totally against our whole system of government. No minority group has had to win their rights at the ballot. And it's, you know, what people who work in the movement sometimes call the gay exception, where courts have, you know, narrowed mm-hmm. this exception for LGBT people that they don't apply to other groups. Now, they have in the past, and they've progressed, and they will on this. But I think the good news to take away, and it is because of films like this and people who are speaking out, is the progress over the last few years. You know, you can look in California, you know, in 10 years, there's been, you know, a 20-point shift. Nationally, we're in the upper 20% supported marriage equality, you know, 10 years ago, and now you're at majority support. So the more people actually stop and think about it, the more they move. And that's sort of one of the big lessons I've learned in this work is, look, if you were raised in a society where this wasn't discussed, right, so you only thought about marriage as being between a man and a woman, until you're forced to stop and think about it and question your assumptions and beliefs, you're not going to. So the more people like all of you, you know, are speaking up and talking about it, the more it's in the news, the more people move. Because once people actually really need to think about this and try and understand their position, they're actually willing to move. And it's amazing how in one conversation you can see the light bulb sort of go off above someone's head like in a cartoon where they get it. It doesn't always happen in one conversation. But without those conversations, it won't happen.
I was very impressed when I read the other day that one of the congressmen who actually drafted the Defense of Marriage Act has come out against it. I mean, there is a bold Republican. Do you know more of the background as to what happened there? I didn't really get into it, but
He's written about sort of changing his view on at least the government, not allowing states to make their own decisions. But we've seen more and more Republicans. You know, in the Prop 8 federal lawsuit, you have Ted Olson, who is a leading conservative voice and Republican, just saying this is so against the values of our country and the ideals of our country. And I think the more you're having leaders like that come out and take those positions, the more it, makes people who are conservative on this issue or haven't really thought about it step back and say, wow, if those people are willing not only to say they support marriage equality, but are actually willing to join the fight, then I need to rethink my position. And this is an issue where, even though polls always show there's a very small undecided group, each year we see this jump in the polls because people will rethink their position. There are maybe a third of the population right now who's very adamantly opposed. But even the rest who are opposed, they're open. They're open to hearing about it. They want to talk to someone they know about it. They want to have the conversation. They're willing to engage. We've seen it when people go door to door. People will want to talk about this issue. So I think it is having the more leaders, the more neighbors, friends, coworkers who are willing to say, look, this is important to me because we're denying someone their basic humanity. We're denying people basic rights. We're hurting people. The more I think people will stop and say, okay, I don't want to hurt people, so let's talk about this. And those conversations are critical. And that is how we will get not just 50% support, but where we need to be, which is, eventually 100% support, but closing in more and more to that day.
Great. You've each made the point that speaking up on this topic is important. And yet I know that most of us find it a little bit difficult to raise this topic, to react to a close friend or family member that's perhaps underinformed or dramatically homophobic on this subject. I'd like to have each of you talk about your own personal experience. How do you effectively stimulate or enter a conversation with friends, colleagues, family, or whatever, in a way that has worked for you? Randy?
Well, so I do two things. One is I do try to make it a civil rights conversation so that you can, and I build on what Melanie mentioned, was separate the church wedding from the civil ceremony. And then I link it back to the fact that all the laws and regulations where if you're going to govern society with the stipulation of married, having just a cascade of benefits that go with it, either you have to fix thousands of laws or you have to fix this one thing to get gay and lesbians treated equally under the federal and state laws. Generally, if you give them several pearls, of which Jeff, the Navy one, I'm going to remember, that is the latest bit of lunacy. But, things like not getting Social Security, not having any medical rights when you have a partner who's ill, children getting turned over to the state in some states. I mean, people realize all of a sudden, geez, there's more to this than just my fear of this going to create a tear in the culture as I see it. I've had this conversation. Believe me, I'm in a massively Catholic area. Well, it's not Catholics, Mormon, which is not a popular conversation, trust me. But I've found several people who are willing to have a, a, a rich dialogue around, okay, why? Why are you? Because they see me and they go, well, why would you care? You don't have any gay. I don't have any gay children. I don't have any gay siblings. That isn't the point. And if you get past this, and again, don't misunderstand my comment. If you get past the religious fervor, the it says in the Bible that. You almost have to cast that aside and deal with it separately, because once you start down the religious path, I've been doomed every time. I've never won a religion. I'm not a very religious guy. I'm an a la carte Catholic, let's be clear. Clearly, I'm sitting up here. The Pope is probably condemning me as we speak. But, you know, I think that's a bit of a fool's errand. You have to treat this from a pragmatic argument perspective, and I think that's all around civil rights.
Well, I think civil rights is a way of discussing this and also reassuring people that in their personal lives and their private lives, they'll be able to hold to whatever religious beliefs they have. I would stress the importance of real-life examples from their own experience and direct experience, and I think the more that people are out and active in our communities, that they sit next to someone, I didn't realize that they were someone for whom, you know, marriage equality would make a difference, or that the ability to marry in California has made a difference. I think the stories about hospitals and not being able to get information about a loved one because of the HIPAA laws, those kinds of personal experience make a difference. I wouldn't totally give up on the religious argument.
Because
I think,
you're a rabbi.
Well, I also I think there's a...
You're better at this than I am, Melanie.
Well, there's sort of a meta-ethics that our religious traditions communicate about every individual being created in the image of God, about respect for people, and I think that's found in many different religious faiths. And if we get above the level of there's this one little law into what does our religion really teach us about how we should treat one another, that sometimes you can make some progress.
It's even effective to be a declared Republican and and come out on this issue, you know? Jeff.
And I want to follow up a little bit on that religious point of view, because one of the things we found in going door to door talking to people who said they voted yes on Prop 8 was the number one reason, like 95%, said it was because of their religious views. And what we found is you can't really get into a debate on that, right? But where you can go is sort of what you're suggesting, which is, well, what is the tenets of your faith? And the number one answer is, you know, love thy neighbor like thyself. And you can start having a conversation. You bring up, well, if your neighbor is a lesbian couple, shouldn't they have the same right to get married that you do? And we did find, you know, you don't move people automatically on that, but you create the conflict. You get them to start thinking about it a little differently. So I don't think we should give up on that issue, although I don't think, you know, you can have the debate. And with, you know, there's one segment you're not going to ever win that debate with. But I think in addition to the rights, it's always important to talk about why people get married. Ask people why they got married. You know, no one will tell you they got married because they were getting, you know, 1,100 federal rights. No heterosexual will give you that answer. Gay people think about it all the time. But what they'll tell you is they met this amazing person. They fell in love. They want to spend their life together. And I found when I've had to talk to strangers about it, and, you know, I've done this professionally, and talking to a cab driver about, you know, this issue is tough, but I always force myself to do it because I was asking other people to do it. I needed to do it. And I always realized the thing that seemed to work the best when I talked about, you know, I'm in love with someone. I want to get married. Why did you get married? Did you get married? You know, and that conversation has really gotten overall a really good response. Not always. It's always can be tough, but really talking about why people get married. Because people, if they go back to that day, when they proposed or when they were asked to get married, their wedding, what it meant, that really will move people because that's the emotional piece. And I think you need to mix the two. You need to mix the rights with the emotional piece because that's what marriage is. It's about love, ultimately.
Interesting point. Very good. Okay, I think it's time to see if we can respond to questions from the audience here. There are two ways you can ask questions. There's the old-fashioned way where you just raise your hand, we'll recognize you, and we'll repeat your question and then try to give you a response. There's also this official question for today's speakers form. If you're bashful and you don't want to be recognized in public and on the radio, then you can do it. You can do it the silent way. But we are eager to find out what's on your mind and try to respond to it. Who wants to go first? There you are. Interesting point. And do you need us to try to repeat the question? Okay. Let's see if I can paraphrase. The point is, in a conversation with any individual, if you were to ask them, when did you decide to become straight, they will have a hard time giving you an answer. Why isn't that question, sort of the rhetorical question about the issue of being gay or what have you? I don't know if I've got that exactly the way you would state it, but fair enough. And Jeff, I think it was directed to you.
Sure. And I think that's it's a great way to engage in a conversation with someone who, especially people who think sexual orientation is a choice, so to speak. One of the things you see in poll after poll is people who believe your sexual orientation is set at birth or an early age are overwhelmingly for equality and for marriage equality. And people who think, you know, it's a choice, people can make it any time in their life, tend to be pretty much opposed. So calling people out on that, I think, is effective. And you've seen it, I think Jon Stewart uses it a good amount on The Daily Show, is he'll ask someone who's opposed to marriage equality, you know, when did you choose to be straight? And it does get people to stop and think. And there's, I think, a way to do it that can be effective without being too threatening. You know, he'll do it in a more threatening way, but he has a big audience. But I do think it gets people to stop and think about, wow, you're right. Like, I couldn't just wake up tomorrow and decide I'm going to be gay any more than a gay person could wake up tomorrow and decide to be straight. So I think it's a really good point and a good tool to use.
Any other comments on that? Very good. Let me take one on the right side here. Please. Okay. The question is that the opposition to this civil right seems to be able to generate significant flow of money in support of its cause, and how can we combat that? How can we activate those funds that might be available that are supportive of this cause? Do I have that? And the operational efficiency as well as the funding that's available. Comments?
I can comment a little bit. I mean, you know, the reality is that just, you know, one group of the right wing, you know, you take focus on the families, budget is bigger than the top 15 LGBT groups combined. And that's a challenge, right? When a small minority group is trying to get their rights against, you know, very well-funded opposition. And one thing that we all have to do is reach out to a broader audience, to have a larger base of people who care about this issue and are willing to donate, to volunteer, to do things. Because it's not enough for the same group of people, you know. We just don't have the same numbers. If our allies and more LGBT people don't get engaged in this fight, we're going to be outspent. So it's just really important, I think, that we reach out to friends, family, people we know, and once they care about this issue, to get them engaged. That, you know, neutrality is really supporting the other side, as I think the film did a great job of pointing out. That if you really care about this issue, if you're going to care about the rights of other people, we just have to have more people engaged. And that has happened. We've seen, you know, the numbers get closer over the years in funding, but it is always an uphill battle.
Was it a surprise in the most recent Prop 8 battle how much money came out in favor of the...
No one expected, $40 million on each side with, unfortunately, most of the yes money coming in early. And what happened was, you know, the Mormon Church did a video that went to every Mormon church in the country and said, it is an act of faith that you must give. And, you know, people mortgaged their homes, took their, you know, kids' college savings accounts to this fight. And that's a very tough thing, you know, to battle. But our community did come back. Our allies came back. You know, a lot of businesses, you know, gave. And we started, you know, catching up towards the end. And I think we are seeing more people engage. But what we need to have happen is people not just engage in a ballot measure fight, mm-hmm. right? People don't move a lot in a ballot measure fight. I mean, every study has shown people sort of end up where they started because people sort of get their position set. When people move is between those fights. People move when you have the time to think about it in a non-political environment. And so getting that constant level of resources for the organizations who are working for equality is key. Because if you get a solid majority before you have a ballot measure fight, you'll be fine. But you have to get there first. You can't do it during that heat of the battle. You have to fight the battle, but you can't just give in that one battle.
And I found it very powerful to see the documentary, I've forgotten the name of it, about the campaign to raise money from the Mormon Church on this topic. What's the
Mormon
Yeah.
The Mormon Proposition. Yes, exactly, which, would influence any common sense individual about, my God, look at this.
I might say a word to the, what do you call it, a la carte Catholics? I hadn't heard that before. That's a great term. But, you know, and to the Presbyterians who haven't been in church for a long time, if your religious denomination is either having this battle or there are more liberal voices that are in danger of being squashed within your religious community, to make yourself present and make yourself heard. That is something that you can do. And, you know, maybe you don't expect a lot of movement, but in some years we've been able to prevent the local Catholic Church from sending in their money because of the amount of objection and the fear that it would hurt other fundraising. That's something legitimately to do.
Good point. A question has come up from the audience here. What is the status of the Prop 8 repeal and other important related pending legislation?
Sure. There are a couple of things. So there's the federal challenge to Prop 8, which won at the trial court level. We're going to get close to a year pretty soon. From that, and a stay was put in place preventing same-sex couples from getting married. During appeal, the Ninth Circuit Federal Court of Appeals did a very expedited hearing while the stay was in place. But then, rather than deciding the case, they sent it to the California Supreme Court to determine if ballot measure proponents could appeal their loss. And the reason for that is because our governor and our attorney general, both our past governor attorney general and our current governor attorney general, have refused to defend Prop 8. They both said it's unconstitutional, it's indefensible. And there's a very strong argument that that should end the case, that only the government gets to represent the people. The four people who decided to put something on the ballot don't get to represent the people. They weren't elected by anyone, and they don't have federal standing. So it's anticipated the California Supreme Court will determine whether California law authorizes them to step in the shoes of the state. That will hopefully be decided sometime this year. We expect oral argument in September and a decision within 90 days. That will then go to the Ninth Circuit, go up to the Supreme Court. It can come back to the Ninth Circuit. I mean, it could be anywhere from the next year to several years in the courts. There are some people who think it should go back to the ballot in November 2012. Obviously, any ballot measure would need to start moving, you know, in the next couple months because there's a long lead-up time to a ballot measure. And I think a lot will depend on what happens in the courts. So it's all in flux. But right now, there's a stay in place, and couples are prevented from getting married. And there's been an effort to get the courts to lift the stay, but at this point, it's still in place. So, you know, every day, someone's being denied the right to marry the person they love.
And could you comment on the federal situation surrounding the Defense of Marriage Act?
Sure. There has been measures introduced in both the Senate and the House to repeal the Defense of Marriage Act. In addition, there are a number of cases moving forward seeking to overturn the Defense of Marriage Act in the courts. And the Obama administration has come out saying they won't defend the Defense of Marriage Act, which is a change in their position, which is really, I think, a major change and is going to have a huge impact on those cases moving forward. And in explaining the decision, Attorney General Holder laid out that any law, in the Obama administration's view, any law that discriminates against people based on sexual orientation is presumed to violate the federal Constitution. So it's really one of the most tremendous things that has come out of the federal government on LGBT issues, and I think we owe a lot of gratitude to the President and the Attorney General for that, because I think it goes a long way to seeing DOMA repealed, whether it's in Congress or in the courts.
Terrific. Okay, we've got a couple of related questions from the audience here, and this gets to the point about what can we really do about this. One question is simple. Let me take that. For the radio audience, how can they see the film? Very good question. We at this Marriage Equality Working Group have copies of the film, and we are ready, willing, and able to distribute that to anyone who is interested in seeing it, and particularly to those who want to take a leadership position and show it to others. That could be your family, it could be your colleagues at work, it could be any group that you feel would benefit from getting the perspectives that are in the film. So, if you will take it upon yourselves to send an email to the following email address and request a copy of the film, we will respond to you. That email address is idowhocant@gmail.com. That's all one word with no punctuation. I do who can't. And I'm sure you can spell that. And if you're interested, we'd love to hear from you. A more intricate question, I think, but also related to our audience that's on the radio. How can the people listening to this program get more engaged as leaders in changing hearts and minds? What are the various things they could do to make a difference here? I'm sure each of you might have ideas on that. You've already mentioned some.
Well, I think the easiest ones is just, you know, having a position that you're willing to state on a regular basis so that people know where you stand as an individual so that you can influence those around you who are influenceable. And I think that happens a lot. I'm regularly surprised, I mean, to the comments we made earlier, that people that I get into the dialogue with start out, you know, sort of way one direction, and I don't move them 100%, but if I can move them 20, two or three times, then we get a semi-ally in this conversation. And I think, the rationale behind why we need to fix this is so compelling that it just we have to keep it out there and keep the dialogue moving.
Good point.
When we work with teenagers, we try to move them from bystanders to upstanders, that is, those who will speak out when they hear something going on. And I think that's one of the things that we can ask everyone who's listening to do. But you're also probably part of some group, whether it's at your work situation, in your religious community, in your civic community, and bringing this issue to all of those different communities can really make a difference.
You know, and I think, you know, just to reiterate sort of on showing the film, is having a tool like the film to invite people over to your home to have a conversation makes it really easy. And I think what's so important is to commit, you know, that in the next week you're going to talk to three people about the issue. And when you have the conversation, you know, one of the things I've learned in doing it, at times, you know, you want to sort of put on that activist hat, but it's to be just open, to have the conversation, to say, you know, ask me anything you want. I'm not, you know, not judgmental. I'm happy to have the conversation. And really be open to it, because you have to be open to people changing their mind, because that's how we're going to win, is having the conversation. Let people take the time to reach the place we need them to get. And that's not going to happen instantly with everyone. It's going to take some time. Coalition of groups in California who work together under the banner Let California Ring, and it's at letcaliforniaring.org, and there are some sample talking points you can pull up. And different things will work that feel comfortable to you, and you'll know what they are, but the important thing is just make the commitment that you're going to talk to three people in the next week about this issue, because once you start doing it, it's going to get easier and easier each time.
You know, I've found some of the environments in which I spend time are places where I'm pretty sure that everybody in the room is probably not on the same side of this issue as I am. And I'll look for a way to raise it. It's relatively easy in my case. Having a gay son, I can say something about that, and then people will respond. I've been flabbergasted how many people are actually on the fence or even potentially advocates for improving the rights here. And if you can find, you know, maybe there are eight people around the table at the golf club and maybe only two of them are on the same side that you are, but the other people start listening and they start thinking. And I'll bet you that a significant number of those people, if you really get into a conversation, will think more openly and clearly about this. And I find it tremendously rewarding if I have been bold enough to open my mouth in an audience like that and come away thinking, you know, it actually went all right. You know, A, there's no downside, and there really can be a significant upside. So I'm always looking for an opportunity, and the more challenging the opportunity, maybe the more interesting it would be. Preaching to the choir is fun, but converting is even more fun. Any other questions? I see one on the back left here.
So I am a supporter, but I have heard the argument about, I'll just say, like, being satisfied with civil partnerships and making the assumption that that would be fixed at a federal level. So it's called something different, but legally it would be treated the same as marriage. And I'm curious to this panel what your thoughts would be on that particular argument.
Okay, the question is, you have heard that perhaps calling it something other than marriage, calling it a civil partnership or whatever, maybe the compromise that is necessary to get legislative support at the federal level and so forth, should we be satisfied with that or not, and why? Who wants to tackle that first?
Well, I think it depends on what problem you think you're solving for. So I believe it's possible you could legislate something that would give you all the legal rights from the federal government perspective by creating a new classification and then bridging them in under the same sweeping law change. I don't think that fundamentally deals with the other issues we've talked about up here, which is if two individuals choose to spend the rest of their lives together, they don't have that opportunity to get the moniker of married, then I still think we haven't solved the emotional side of this thing. And what I would say is sort of the needed move of the culture of America today. So I'm not certain we should satisfy ourselves with a legislative answer that creates another class of citizen to solve this issue. It's just my view.
I don't feel in a position to tell anyone what strategy to pursue, but I would just say, as someone who struggled for the rite of ordination, you know, being offered something that would be sort of like being a rabbi but with a different name just was not all that appealing. And the Orthodox Jewish community is doing that right now, and it really has not worked out well for them because they're still criticized by those who oppose that. And meanwhile, they've created sort of this quasi-rabbinic role. So as a woman, sort of just is not the same, and I would not feel that positively.
Yeah. And ultimately, creating a separate institution and calling it something else for no purpose other than one, which is to stigmatize a group of people, because it serves no legitimate purpose. You're going to say, oh, it's really the same thing. We're going to call it something different. And I think, you know, the rabbi's point is exactly on point. But I think it also goes to the other issue that was raised. You know, if you ask a heterosexual married couple if they're willing to give in their marriage license for a domestic partnership in California, you're not going to find a lot of takers. And that gets people to think, you know, marriage means something in our society. It has meaning. It has significance. There's dignity and respect. It's not just a bundle of rights. And you're denying a whole group of people that dignity and respect. You're denying a whole group of young people that dignity and respect and feeling that they can live their lives fully equal in our society by calling it something else for no purpose other than really to dehumanize a group of people.
I have a question that's come up sometimes. Young people ask why we don't have We Won't Get Married Month or something within the heterosexual community as a way of expressing more support, or some ceremony at the wedding. Some Jewish couples take some wine out of their cup for those who can't marry, and I wonder if that's caught on at all.
You know, there are people who, I mean, I do know some people have said they're not getting married till everyone can get married. But, you know, I think no one should deny themselves, you know, the joy that comes with marriage. But I do think, you know, there have been many couples, and I have friends who have done this, who have talked about that at their weddings, that why it's important. People have made donations and asked people to give to this cause at their weddings. You know, ultimately, you want everyone to have rights. You don't want anyone else to lose them. But there are a lot of, you know, heterosexual couples who have stood in solidarity, and that's really gratifying when people are willing to actually give something up until everyone can have their rights.
And there certainly aren't any examples where a civil right was granted in faux fashion to some group that was given a different title. I mean, it can't work. It can't work inside a corporation. It can't work inside any body of society. And, you know, that compromise seems ill-advised and unnecessary in my mind. Any other questions from the audience? I have another one, and I think we've touched on this in a lot of different angles, but, you know, it's very obvious why the lesbian, gay, bisexual people have a stake in this. I mean, they're directly affected. They're adversely affected in all kinds of ways. Why should the rest of society really care? What difference is this going to make to families, to the communities, and so forth? Is there a real reason why we will all benefit?
Okay, I'll go first. We can make the old guy go first every time. So I would
I'm
make
the old guy.
I'm not going to steal that from you either. I would make the point that the reason we should care is because when we start allocating civil rights on some basis other than everything for everybody, it puts everyone at risk ultimately, because you never know when you're going to hit on something where there's an issue with something that affects you. And it could be something, I don't think, pick on green-eyed people all of a sudden. Who knows? I think if we're going to be consistent to the theory of civil rights, then we should be consistent to it. And as a result, then I think we all own this together, and we shouldn't look at this as just a gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender problem. I think this is a civil rights issue that all of us should care about, because it says who we are as a nation. And the minute we start infringing on our fundamental cultural norm, it puts the whole thing at risk in my mind.
I think you're speaking to principles that have really been part of American democracy, that we're only as free as the least free member of our society. And I think we've also talked about the value of role modeling for young people, that as young people are growing up, they see marriage equality as a way of saying that, yes, they are also valued, and these are important things.
Good point.
Now, I would just add, I think as a society, we all benefit when everyone reaches their potential. I mean, everyone benefits when we're living in a society where people care about each other, want other people to have their rights. And I think, you know, what the rabbi just said about young people being able to grow up in a world and know that they're going to be accepted is just going to have such a transformative effect on their lives and on society. And to think that we would sit back and while one young LGBT person commits suicide because they feel unequal and that they can't live their hopes and dreams, and that anyone would sit back and allow that to happen, I just don't believe anyone, if they really thought about it, would not act to make sure we can protect that young person.
Good point. Looking at the clock, I see that we are nearing the end of our allotted time here. We have time for one more short question, if anyone has one. And if not, we can wrap this up. Any other questions from the audience? Seeing none, let me again thank the organizations that made this possible. That includes the Commonwealth Club of Silicon Valley. It includes the Women's Club of San Jose. It includes the Marriage Equality Working Group of the American Leadership Forum. And all of those organizations are to be commended for being helpful in letting public conversations like this take place, and I want to thank all of them. It's been a fun evening for us, and I'd really like to thank our three panelists, Randy Pond from Cisco, Melanie Aaron from Congregation Shir Hadash, and Jeff Coors from Equality California, three very interesting panelists, very interesting people, and very interesting advocates for what we hope will be a rapid and significant change in our culture, in our laws and regulations, and in the basic fabric of American life. So with that, let me ask all of you to give them a hand and... Thank you. Thank you very much. And in the tradition of the Commonwealth Club, this gavel signifies the end of our program. Oh my goodness.